Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has a new podcast every 2 weeks with up-to-date information about aviation technologies for general and business aviation. From home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech, Plain Talk provides informative information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 1,900 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology and aviation industries. I'd like to welcome Christine Gervais, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Canadian Owners and Pilots Associations, or COPA, into the Plain Talk cockpit. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Phil, and thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. How is scenic downtown Ottawa?
This morning, it's actually a glorious morning. The sun is shining. The sky is blue. Tad cold outside, but I'm actually not someone who minds the cold. I love winter sports. So to me, it's I'm looking forward to the weekend so I can put some skis on.
So I like to refer to it as severe VFR.
It is severe VFR, yes.
I understand that you've decided to start the journey to purchase your first airplane.
I have, yeah. Ever since I started in aviation, I always knew that one day I would own my own aircraft. And the timing was never right, obviously. Career, children, well, child in my case. But I feel like now is the time. And I think I have so many resources at my availability that I think there will be no other perfect time to start doing this.
I think any time is the perfect time, but that's, I'm biased. With that said, for the viewing audience, what kind of ratings do you have?
So I have a multi IFR land and seaplane rating.
Awesome. So you've been flying for quite a while, haven't you?
I have, yes. My flying career started in my early 20s. After a fateful day at the Aviation Museum, watching airplanes take off and land, it ended my medical career and it began my aviation career.
Wow.
So it's been a while. I literally had to look through a phone book to find a school to get me up in the air for the first time. The only planes I'd ever been on were the big commercial ones that would take me to faraway destinations, and never even imagined being in the cockpit of one of those until that day and until that first flight. Yep.
What was that first flight like?
It was, I think it was the day I realized that life can be an adventure. There's no other way to describe it. It was definitely the day I discovered that, you know, life can take you in different directions and you have to follow your gut sometimes. And that was the day for me.
Well, certainly for me, it was fulfilling a lifelong dream when I started building balsa wood and tissue model airplanes at the tender age of 5. And who knew I could actually sit inside that little model and take it up.
Well, you didn't literally sit inside that model, though, did you?
No, although the kids got me a little bobblehead mini me, we could put it in. As you started down the journey of finding your dream aircraft, just talk about how you've looked at that journey and your mission. What's driving you to what kind of airplane?
So my first... obviously, I think the first type of plane I thought about getting was a float plane. Float flying is my first love. It's how I started my commercial aviation career. It's what I finished my commercial hours on was a small Aronca Champ on floats. And, you know, the freedom of float flying to me has always been some of the best memories I have about flying. Is when I was flying floats. And then, but I also, you know, realistically, I want to be able to visit my members. They're not always at big airports. So renting an aircraft somewhere is not really it's not really practical because you can't always go to the various airports. They would have to be registered. And I also want to teach my son how to fly. So my son is now 16 years old. He just turned 16 and really wants to earn his private pilot's license, and asked if I could be the one who teaches him. So twofold, I'd like to get my instructor rating so that I can actually teach my son his private pilot's license.
Wow, wonderful.
Yeah.
Sounds like your son could possibly have his PPL before his driver's license.
It's looking that way, yes.
very cool. So also sounds like flying is in your family's DNA.
I'm actually first generation pilot. There are no pilots in my family. And for me, it really was about watching those little planes take off and land and being drawn towards it. And his father is also a commercial pilot for Air Canada.
Oh, wow.
So yes, it's definitely in his DNA for sure. He's grown up with two parents that talk about flying incessantly. So how could he not?
And how cool to add a airplane to the ground fleet, if you will.
Exactly. Yes. Oh, he's very excited about that.
Two cars, one snowmobile, one float plane.
One car, no snowmobiles, oh. But a plane.
Well, I think it's way more fun than snowmobiles, but that's just
agreed.
Me. So you started down this journey, something that your son can learn to fly on, something you can do your instructor's rating. Sounds like the third leg of that mission stool is to cross countries to go Air Christine as opposed to Air Canada, go visit
yep.
the membership. So have you started to whittle that shopping list into you know, a couple of different makes or models?
I have, actually. I think when I first started the journey, I really didn't know everything that was out there. I was familiar with the types of aircraft that I had flown or that, you know, my close friends had flown, but I really wasn't familiar with all of the availability that was out there. And I think for me, one of the hardest parts was to actually find airplanes that were for sale. I don't, you know, there isn't one single place where, you know, as a Canadian pilot, I can go and look. I'd like that to be Canadian plane trade. But right now, you know, there's many different websites that you have to go through. And as you talk to one person, they tell you about another one. And so I've been compiling all of the different websites, you know, to continuously look. And I have looked into a few airplanes. I think I was a little bit enchanted by a little bit more power, a little bit more high performance. But when it came time to actually look at whether or not this was a good fit, I always came back to the fact that this is something that I want my son to learn on. And, you know, I can always upgrade later. I think we had talked about that before, you know, stick to, you know, my main reasons for wanting to get this aircraft. And then, you know, when that reason isn't there anymore, then you can always look at an upgrade. And so I think I've nailed it down now to either a Cessna 172 or a Cherokee 140 or 160. I think those are good trainers. You know, they're good airplanes. You can cross country with them. And So I think that anything in that range, I may not know all of the airplanes that are good trainers, but right now those are the two models that I'm really, that I think I've drilled it down to.
Certainly well adopted by Canadian flight schools, no doubt.
So there's that too. And they're easily insurable as well. So the insurance aspect was definitely one that I kept in mind. You know, there's a lot of home builds out there as well that. But of course, insurance companies don't particularly like those. So I did want something that was, you know, easily insurable for myself and for my son to use as a trainer.
So I've always heard other pilots hangar talk about high wing versus low wing airplanes, and it almost seems a little bit like a cult. What are your thoughts?
I'll be honest, I've never flown in a low wing. So I, well, actually, that's not true. I flew a Piper Aero, but not myself as a passenger. I don't really have an opinion one way or another. I mean, I haven't given it any thought one way or another. To me, it's really about the performance of the aircraft and where the wing is, you know, as long as it's on the airplane and attached to it. That's my preference.
Well, sadly, if it wasn't attached at 3,000 feet, you'd have a completely different thing to worry about.
Correct. The aerodynamics would work differently at that time.
So have you thought, and it's probably a bad word, but have you thought about a budget at all?
No. Well, a budget for purchasing, yes. I've set the money aside so that, you know, I have set a budget for myself for the purchase price. I think once I found the airplane that, or at least the type of airplane that I wanted to look for, then I'd have to start thinking about where I'm gonna put it and how much that's gonna cost. I do have the insurance cost, and then I'll have to, you know, budget, you know, do a yearly budget on, you know, how much I plan on flying and what that's gonna cost me. And then there's the annual, and there's I guess the way I'm seeing it is almost like budgeting for a house. And you know, you have to budget a certain amount every month for in cases, and then the usual stuff that you have to budget for a house. So that's going to come as soon as I decide, what airplane I'm going to get and where I'm going to put it. We'll have to start budgeting for that and planning for it. So there's definitely a plan in the works for a budget, but there's no budget right now as far as ongoing costs.
Yeah, I was chatting with a 172 owner, friend of mine, and she, when I asked her a similar question, she said, I've owned the airplane for 15 years, and I really don't want to know how much I spend annually on my baby.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna have one eye open on this and one eye closed. you don't want to give it too much thought. But for me, it's not just about, it's not about the money. It's about when else am I going to do this? And we have one life, and this is what I want to do with mine.
I seem to recall there's some very cool guides on the Copa National website to help folks purchase their first airplane.
There are, and there's definitely a budget guide in there as well that I have refused to read right now.
Uh-oh. You don't want to spoil the dream, shall we say? Throw water on
that's
the
right.
dream.
that's right. I don't want to knock it before it's a done deal. The plane is purchased, and then I'm like, okay, now let's face reality.
Yeah, and I think that part of the reality, you know, to have some, fiscal responsibility is called partners or partnerships, if you will, to help split the costs. I like to think that airplanes spend most of their time sitting in hangars, and subsequently there's an ideal opportunity to for those inclined to share their airplane with other folks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, a partnership can be very successful if it's done properly. And you're right. It's not good for an airplane to sit around to be flown only 10 hours per year. So, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where that's happening, then I would suggest to find some people that you trust that can put some time on the airplane and share the costs that comes with putting time on an airplane as well. And for myself, I did consider it, and I'm not considering it. But I do think that for the next couple of years, we're going to be busy with the aircraft, that it doesn't necessarily make sense to go into a partnership. I do plan on using it a lot. And, with my position and the fact that I really would like to start, you know, traveling and going to meet some of our members across the country, the plane's going to be gone a lot. So I'm not sure if a partnership works for me at this time, but it's definitely something that, you know, I'm not saying that down the line, it's not something that will work if I want something that's a little bit higher performing for an upgrade and that sort of thing, because, you know, but that's in 2 years. So we'll see. We'll see what life is like in 2 years. I do want to point out too that, you know, while I was an air traffic controller, I wasn't flying a whole lot, and that getting back into flying has been slightly intimidating. And you know, I'm not afraid to admit that. And I am flying with an instructor right now, or somebody that is qualified, that has a lot of time, just to refresh my skills. You know, for me, if I haven't flown in 6 months, I feel like, you know, my skills are somewhat degrading. I do have in my back pocket, you know, some qualified pilots for safety for me on the right seat, so that I feel safe and comfortable. And I'm going to keep doing that until, you know, I have enough time on this new aircraft that I'm purchasing.
No doubt, safety first, and time and experience can, you know, really safeguard the next flight. That.
Yeah. So I do have over 2,500 hours, but
wow.
Most of those were done, you know, over 15 years ago. So I don't really count them anymore. So, you know, they don't count towards my flying now. Of course, you know, things come back a lot easier when you've got that amount of time. But I still feel like I need that safety net for the first little while to get back up there.
Do you find it's like riding a rusty bike?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I think the first few times I went back, especially, you know, after it had been like maybe a year and a half since my last flight, it took me a little while to just get that flow back. Just, you know, the flow of how you look at your instruments constantly and how you do your scan. I think that came back pretty quickly, but I actually had to be in the airplane and flying it in order for it to come back. So I'm glad I had that safety person next to me, which was a qualified instructor, you know, that can sort of monitor all of the other little things I might be forgetting while I'm trying to remember that scan. So, it did come back. I think, you know, the landings, the takeoffs, the steep turns and the stalls and you know, I always like to go through all of that with an instructor on board once a year. And those parts were easy and they came back really easily. But for me, it was really about the navigation skills. Like that's the part that was that needed a little bit more time to come back.
And when we say navigation skills, are kind of talking about dead reckoning versus a GPS and ForeFlight on your knee.
Exactly. It's even ForeFlight. I mean, ForeFlight didn't exist. You know, when I was a commercial pilot, it was all maps. You know, getting used to ForeFlight for me is something new as well. But it's about, you know, constantly knowing to look out the window, then inside at your instruments, and there's, you know, there's a whole scan involved with flying, and it was getting that, you know, and looking at your instruments and looking out the window is just it like it's as big a part of the navigation as following your map on ForeFlight on your iPad. So. To me, that was the you know, I'd say the hardest part to get back.
So as you know, you go down the search for your new baby. Have you started to think about the upgrades and tech toys, shall we say, that add to your flight bag and airplane?
Yes. So I've got my ForeFlight subscription. And I play with that on a regular basis. I like to play with it on the ground because I like to know how to get to things quickly for, you know, when I am in the air, I have access to the information quickly and I know where to go and I'm not thinking about, well, where was that tab again? And for the airplane itself, well, obviously I'd like to put in a glass cockpit at some point, but that's probably not realistic.
Big bucks.
But yeah, you know, like or a nice Garmin with a moving map. I do think about those things, and you know, obviously you have to think about being compliant with the 406, and then the hopefully not inevitable of ADS-B, and what that's going to look like, and Dream cockpit is a glass one.
And I think that what's interesting that balances the glass cockpit could cost more than the 172, but with with ForeFlight, not all the other tech, you really do see these hybrids. What's on your knee versus what's on the panel?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and there's still some affordable options for the panel.
But when I think of airplanes, the last thing I think is affordable.
Yes, that's right. I do use the word affordable in quotation marks.
Have you zeroed down on an airplane yet?
There's a couple that, I think right now there are two that I've put in word that I'm interested in. And I think my job this weekend is going to call around to see where I can park it. I'd love to park it downtown in front of my house. But the Glebe doesn't allow airplane parking yet. Anyway,
well, that's annoying,
isn't it? You think downtown they'd allow anything, but they don't. And so I think my job is going to be finding a place that's convenient, and deciding whether or not I'm looking for space where I can hangar my airplane all the time, or at least have access to a hangar where I can put my plane overnight. If I want to do a morning flight in the wintertime. So that's my next. I think my next research is that. Before actually taking an airplane home.
Well, I can tell you personally, when I had block time on a 182RG in Toronto, that scraping the snow and ice in January, digging it out of the off the ramp, just wasn't fun. And 2 hours later, the last thing I was thinking about was going flying.
takes a little bit of the fun out. Yeah.
Oh, it sure does. Minus 10 degrees, building up a good sweat, and then getting cold.
Well, considering all of the other pre-flight checks that you have to do once that's done, right? You're still not ready to go, even though the snow is off your airplane. So,
yeah, and this particular spot didn't have a TANF, so I had to manhandle the aircraft out of the snowbank to an area on the ramp near an electrical outlet, plug it in, go have coffee for a couple of hours, come back. Going, maybe I need to talk to the owner about a possibility of hangaring the airplane in the wintertime. I'm looking at the other folks that had their airplanes pulled out, plugged in, ready to go. They do the walk around, hop in, and execute their mission.
Yeah, so for me, that's definitely going to be, and it's by talking to people like you that you realize that the things that you hadn't necessarily considered that, because I always thought, oh, why not Rocklift? But then Rocklift doesn't have hangar space. You have to wait for the snow to melt off your airplane naturally. You have to brush it off yourself. And so you're limiting yourself to the type of flying you can do in the wintertime. And I'm not sure I want to do that. So I'm going to, step two.
Any final words or what's on the horizon, Christine?
I have to say that this has been quite exciting looking for my first airplane. It's been very exciting. I'm lucky to have a lot of people that I get to talk to about this because it's the world that I put myself in. So the future is, you're going to find me at one of your airports and shaking your hand whenever that's allowed again, or, at least doing an elbow thing. I'm sure that's still allowed at some point. And just really getting to meet the people that I represent. That's what I really, really want to do.
Awesome. Well, Christine, thank you so much for being part of Plane Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Phil, for having me. And I want to thank you for all of the information that you've also provided me for my search. I really do appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at plaintalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at plaintalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.